Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Hey, the man on the board, our producer, Nolan Ford, just told me this is our 100th episode. Hard to believe. I wonder how many interviews I've done if you throw in all the episodes of our predecessor, the Blue Dot Report. More than 100, that's for sure. Well, for our 100th broad and podcast, we have a volcanic theme for you. Later on in the show, we're going to look at a unique and innovative program of undergraduate students doing real scientific research under the direction of volcanologist Rachel Teasdale, professor of geology at California State University at Chico. It was a lot of fun hearing the enthusiasm that these students have for their projects. Amy Robson and Angie Rodriguez are studying the complex geothermal systems beneath Lassen Volcanic National Park. It's the largest hydrogeothermal system west of Yellowstone in one of California's most potentially active and dangerous volcanic centers. Then Evan Davis will tell us about his modeling of lava flows on Mars, which may have been very similar to what we're seeing occurring on Hawaii right now. And speaking of the Big Island, it's time to check in with our expert on volcanoes, Eric Clemente, to get his inside story of what's happening with the world's most active volcano, Kilauea. Eric is a professor in the Department of Geosciences at Denison University in Ohio and author of the blog Rocky Planet for Discover Magazine. Eric, welcome to Blue Dot. Eric, could you start out with just give us like a little quick 101 on Kilauea? What kind of volcano is it?
Yeah, I mean, Kilauea is fascinating. I mean, actually, the whole Big Island of Hawaii is five overlapping volcanoes of various ages that formed over the last few million years from a hotspot that sits underneath Kilauea and Mauna Loa right now. And this hotspot is an area of hot material that's rising up through the mantle from almost 2,900 kilometers beneath your feet if you're standing on Kilauea. And as that stuff rises through the mantle, it will start to melt and then collect at about 100 kilometers. And then all that magma will start to then rise up into the crust, the oceanic crust, and erupt at Kilauea. And Kilauea itself has been active for maybe a couple hundred thousand years and is building on to that east side that people tend to think of. But it's forming from this hot material rising up through the mantle.
So it's very different then from the volcanoes in Northern California and Oregon and Washington, like Shasta and Mount Hood and mountains like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, so I have two projects right now that I'm personally working on, one at Lassen Peak and one at Mount Hood. So those volcanoes are forming from the plate, the Juan de Fuca plate off the coast of North America, sliding down underneath North America and melting the mantle above it, and forming these volcanoes that have steep sides and can be more explosive that we tend to think of that you find along the Cascades. So it's a very different style of eruption, although you do find some volcanoes that are kind of like Kilauea in the Cascades in Oregon because you get more basalt, that hot, runny lava that you think of when you think of Hawaiian volcanism. But most of the Cascades are those steeper, more explosive volcanoes.
Well, let's talk about this current eruptive cycle and what's going on in Leilani Gardens, because, you know, this all kind of started with this lava lake in the crater of Kilauea. And could you explain to us why this lava wound up in this subdivision?
Yeah, it's interesting because so we're at Kilauea about 2 months ago on a field trip from our geology department, and we're talking to the USGS geologists at the Hawaii Volcano Observatory, and they're saying that there's a lot of inflation going on at the summit and at this other vent that's down on this East Rift Zone called Pu'uo'o, and both of those places had lava lakes at the time. And the lava lake at the summit was almost to the point where they thought it was going to spill over soon. And then a couple of weeks later, it actually ended up spilling over some. And all of those signs suggested that there was a lot of new magma coming up and pressure was building inside the volcano. And most of Kilauea is really just this big plumbing system that takes magma from the summit out this East Rift and all the way out to the Pacific for, I think it's about maybe 40 kilometers or more down to the Pacific along this rift. And most of the time, over the last 35 years or so, the magma has gone out these conduits and erupted at Pu'u'o'o, which is still within the national park. But for reasons that I think people are still going to be working on for a while to figure out exactly why, the eruption down at Leilani Estates is well past Pu'u'o'o, further to the east. And it seemed like, for whatever reason, the magma started to travel further down the rift and past Pu'u'o'o and all the way down to the Leilani Estates. And as it's kind of been described to me, it's like a burst pipe where it finally reached the point where the pressure was high enough in the conduit that you started to get these cracks forming at the surface. And that's how the eruption started. But exactly why all of a sudden Kilauea was flushing this magma out from the summit, where the lava lake level has dropped something like 900 feet. And then Pu'u'o'o, just the whole lava lake there disappeared, more or less. And now we have this new eruption starting down at Leilani Estates. It's I think no one is quite sure why exactly now is the time that it decided to do that.
And the latest news is that the lava is really lowering and they're worried about it getting down to the water table. Could you explain to us why that's a problem?
Well, there, so the lava lake at the summit, the Halemaumau lava lake, which has been active for just over 10 years now, if it the level of that lava lake drops down below the water table, you kind of have two things going on. One is that it's a really steep-sided conduit. It's not like a lake like you might think of, a shallow lake with a, like, you know, a basin shape to it, but it's just a conduit of lava. So it's a big tube. And as it drops further and further down, the sides are really steep, so you can get rock fall down into the lava lake, that the surface might be, like I said, about 900 feet down right now. And it is, I think at this point, it is below the water table. So you get some water in there and you have steam coming out. So if you look at the webcams pointed at the summit right now, you'll see this white plume, which is all steam. But if you get a bunch of rock fall and you have a bunch of steam, you can trap that steam and build up a lot of pressure. And then the water can interact with the magma and get a pack a lot of explosive punch that will then blast that rock that had fallen into the crater out, sort of like popping the cork on a champagne bottle, and you get this explosive eruption. And that's what they think could happen and has happened in the past. I think 1924 is the most recent time, but that's the next potential hazard from this period at Kilauea. And I just saw that the FAA has put a no-fly zone over Kilauea just in case something like that happens.
Sounds prudent. And of course, we don't know what's going to happen. It's just that's a strong possibility, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the game right now, is that there's a higher likelihood of an explosive eruption, just like there is a higher likelihood that some of these fissures down at Leilani Estates could start erupting lava again. There's still earthquakes down there that suggest that magma is moving. And then there's still all this sulfur dioxide coming out, all these gases that you see pictures of all the gases coming out of the cracks. It all suggests that magma is down there at Leilani Estates underneath the ground. And that I think right now they're just waiting to see what is that next step. What's that next event going to be? They expect something's going to happen. They don't know what, and I don't think they would guarantee that we're going to see an explosive eruption at the summit or new vents at Leilani Estates, but the chances are much higher than they have been for both of those things to happen right now.
It's interesting to me because it seems like there's this kind of dichotomous situation you have there, because for the people who live in Leilani Estates, this is just a tragic thing for them. To, you know, losing their homes, losing their property, and not knowing, you know, if, when they'll ever be able to return. Of course, you know, on the other hand, you know, you build homes on the flank of the world's most active volcano, and that is, you know, something that's got to be in the back of your mind as a possibility. On the other side of the equation, for people like you that are volcanologists and interested in volcanoes, this has to be extremely exciting and interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the challenges of being a volcanologist, is that the events that happen at a lot of volcanoes put, there is a significant chance that it's putting people in harm's way. And part of the excitement is always tempered by the fact that you hope that it is something that the people who are there can have the least, be least impacted by the eruption. So, you know, you look at this eruption down at Lalani Estates, and on, if independent of the fact that there are people there, it's fascinating to think about the fact that the volcano is erupting down at this far end of the East Rift Zone for the first time in 60 years, and why that might be and where the magma's coming from, all those sorts of questions. But, you know, the fact that eruptions like this can last for months or maybe or longer, that people's homes are going to be destroyed, and that at other places on Kilauea where these sorts of things have happened, we've seen entire subdivisions just get repaved by new lava. So it is, you have to keep that in mind when you're discussing these eruptions, because it is, there are people being directly impacted, and they could be directly impacted for years down the road from these events.
Yes, because this could last for months, for years. We just really don't know, do we?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, is that you look at some of the other subdivisions that have had lava flow issues over the last 30 years, and, you know, Royal Gardens on Kilauea is another example where the eruptions there that sent lava flows across that subdivision started in, I think, the mid-80s, and the last house was taken out by a lava flow, I think, in 2012. So there's like a few decades worth of lava flows that can potentially impact. I'm not saying that this Lalani Estates eruption might last that long, but, you know, the potential is there. You know, I think I saw that the Hawaii Volcano Observatory folks were saying that eruptions like this might last on the scale of, you know, 80 or 90 days. So that's at least a few months worth of eruption that can, you know, that's already taken out at this point after about a week. 117 acres. So we could see significant lava flows coming from this for at least a few weeks or months to go.
We're basically out of time, but real quick, I'd like to get your elevator speech pitch, if you will, about why is it that volcanoes have fascinated you personally? What is it about them that makes you so interested in them?
Yeah, I guess that real quick, that it's twofold here, is that part of it is that I grew up near volcanoes, not in the U.S., but in Colombia, where my mother's side of the family is all from Colombia. So I have this recollection of seeing Nevado del Ruiz a few years after it had its big eruption that killed 25,000 people. And I think that made an impression, seeing some of the devastation related to that. But for me right now, I really like understanding what are the events that lead up to an eruption, and can we get a better understanding of how quickly a volcano can go from a state where it doesn't erupt to a state that is in eruption. And we really don't have a good grasp of that. And that's a really fascinating question to me.
Well, thank you so much, Eric, for your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks to Eric Clemente, professor of geosciences at Denison University and blogger for Discover Magazine. I'm Dave Sloan, and you are listening to Blue Dot. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk to two women undergraduate students who are doing research projects on a mainland volcanic center, Lassen Volcanic National Park. Stay with us, and thanks for listening. Welcome back to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. Our next guests are two women doing research on the hydrogeothermal system at Lassen Volcanic National Park. It's unusual for undergraduate students to do real scientific research, but that's exactly what Amy Robson and Angie Rodriguez are doing as part of their geology majors at California State University Chico, which also happens to be the home of Blue Dot. So Amy and Angie, welcome to the program. So what I'd like to know from each of you first, and you can answer in whatever order you'd like, is when did you decide that you want to study geology? Because for a lot of kids that I talk to that are teenagers before they go to college, pursuing a degree in geology would seem, like a very strange thing for them to think about. When did you decide that geology was something you were really interested in and you wanted to pursue that?
Amy here. I am actually a return student, so I came back to school in my mid-20s, and I had left a culinary world to go back to school to pursue science, and it took me some time to figure out what kind of science I really wanted to get into, because I kind of had a broad interest in everything. And after some reading and some, not soul searching, but just some reflecting, I realized geology is something I kind of always been interested in. And that's just, I went back to school with that career goal in mind of being a geologist. I really like rocks and how things are formed. And that was very fascinating for me. So that's how I ended up there.
Hi, this is Angie. I think that I decided I wanted to be a geologist and follow that career path when I really didn't like my first major. I was in it for about a year, and then I decided that it wasn't what I wanted to do.
So if you could visualize, your dream jobs, what would they be or what would that look like?
This is Angie here. I think I see myself studying how economic deposits form, like how gold and silver deposits come to be. I think that would be cool.
And Amy here. And for myself, I have always had an interest in more of the environmental side of geology. My first professor in my introduction to geology class was, he was previously an environmental consultant. And I had a chance to talk to him about that because I was the only geology major in that class. And I wanted to ask him what he did before he started teaching. And that just sounded very fascinating, the idea of cleaning up the mess that people make, but also in the field of geology. And there's a lot of applications for that. The environmental geology and hydrogeology, there's lots of things you can do involving the cleanup process.
Well, let's talk about your specific undergraduate research projects. Could you give me the technical titles of what you're both working on?
Hi, this is Angie. I'm working on characterizing trends in the Lassen hydrothermal system.
And this is Amy. I'm working on constructing mineral alteration assemblages of the hydrothermal system at Lassen.
So would that be like the actual title of your research project?
For the most part, yes.
Okay. Now, explain to me, being like your grandpa, what is it exactly you're doing?
What I am doing is I'm collecting samples of clay minerals. So clay is an alteration process of different rock minerals. And it's how they interact with the hydrothermal system. So it's very hot water, hot steam, and how those change in relation to those systems.
And of course, we're talking about the hydrothermal system up at Lassen Volcanic National Park, right?
Yes.
How did you go about deciding to do those as your research projects?
For myself, I would. I came into it recently. I am actually kind of Angie's protege for the most part, kind of. But I'll let her discuss that part, how she got there.
So Rachel Teasdale, my name is Angie, and Rachel Teasdale, our professor and advisor, she has had this ongoing project monitoring the hydrothermal system at the Lassen Volcanic Centers for a while, since 2006, I think, around that time. And she's passed it on from student to student who's been interested in that kind of research. And I joined on about 2 years ago, and we've been working on it since then together.
So how much time do you actually, because it sounds like you both like being out of doors, and of course, you know, what a wonderful place to be out of doors up there. I would assume you're exploring places like Sulphur Works and Bumpus Hell Thermal Area and Drake's Bad and places like that. How much time do you get to actually spend out in the field when you're doing this work?
This is Angie here. I would say about a weekend every month.
And could you describe for us, like, what do you do, like, when you're out there? What kind of instruments do you use? What kind of measurements are you taking? What are you actually doing out there? Because I always, you know, find it fascinating to think when you go to a place like that, you know, most of us go there, walk on the boardwalks, look at the cool mud pots and steam vents and think, wow, that's really cool. But when you're a scientist, an undergraduate scientist, but you're still a scientist, what do you actually do?
Amy and I do similar but different things. What I do is I collect water samples from cool and hot water sources. And how I do that is I have a yardstick, and at the very end, there's this little metal clamp that we clamp bottles to, and we insert those into the various cool water streams and hot water streams and mud pots to collect water samples. And then we analyze them here at the Chico State Lab. And so that's what I do. And Amy does a little bit of different sampling.
Mine, since it's focusing on rock and clay samples, it is the glorious task of scooping mud essentially into bags. But then we have a process via XRD analysis, which is X-ray diffraction. It helps determine the mineralogy of the sample.
So you actually figure out exactly what minerals are in those samples?
Yes.
And where do you do that?
We have ours sent away to the University of Idaho, and then they process the samples and then send us back the data.
Can you share with us some interesting findings that you've had that you could tell us about? You know, what is it that's going on with that hot water, with the acids in there, and interacting with those rock to turn it into clay?
With my samples, it's still very preliminary. We are just focusing on the Sulphur Works area of Lassen, and so we're trying to see if there's any trends going on. And right now, we are planning to do a bigger sampling area, just because right now it's kind of limited to what we have done, and it's not telling us. It's telling us some things, not too much, unfortunately. So we need to do a larger sampling to see if there's any larger trends across the area.
Well, that's part of the process of science too, isn't it? When you know, nothing going on there, now we got to investigate it in a different way.
Absolutely.
And do you get to, I would imagine, since you're working at the geothermal areas, which are, you know, dangerous, that you work with park personnel?
When we go, this is Amy, Angie and I usually go up together. We always go in pairs. And if not with each other, with another partner, just for safety reasons. And we limit ourselves to where we try to walk and have access to. We always make sure that we have orange construction vest on to let other visitors know not to go where we're going, because it can be quite dangerous. And we just make sure that we know where to walk in those areas to make sure that we don't break through the surface, because there are some very hot vents right underfoot.
Yes, a friend of mine who works for the United States Geological Survey, Patrick Muffler, I don't know if you're familiar with his work there at Sulphur Works, But, you know, I always, you know, talking to Patrick, because he's been studying that area for decades, I always assumed, you know, it's like, well, you guys know exactly where to step and what to do, and, you know where it's safe. And he said, oh, no, there's been many times when I've, you know, accidentally at Yellowstone or at Lassen Park stepped in the wrong place and gotten badly burned. So it is worth noting that those are dangerous places to be.
Very much so.
And do you find that exciting? Not the danger part, but just that that's an active volcanic area.
I think it's very exciting. I love geology as a whole, and I love the age and the deep age of a lot of the rocks and samples that you see. But at the same time, it's active. It's an active geologic process that's happening literally underfoot. And that's very fascinating, and it's exciting to see.
Do you get an opportunity, either of you or both of you, to interact or work with or contact professional scientists, say at the USGS, who've been working there, or to at least, you know, review some of the work they've done?
Hi, this is Angie here. So I haven't personally met. I have personally met, but some USGS scientists. But in terms of like working with them, I haven't done that yet. But that is to be done. But what I have done is I've used a lot of their published public reports and public data that they have put out through USGS yearly reports to further analyze different trends that we may see in Lassen. So that's something that we do with USGS data.
And how long does a project like this take? Give me a sense of, like, is this a year-long study that you do for this class, or a semester, or longer?
Our projects, Amy here, our projects are definitely ongoing, because there's a lot of the Lassen Volcanic Center to research, and it kind of builds on itself. So with my clay analysis is kind of, I picked up off of Angie's water and the geochemical water analysis. And so it's kind of builds upon each other to build a better picture, a broader picture of the area. So there's always work to be done, even just within that volcanic center.
But how long does, you know, you're at, like, you get a, I'm assuming you get a grade at the end of this. What does that look like? Is there like a poster that you present at a conference, or, you know, what do you do to get your units for this class, to put it bluntly?
Hi, this is Angie. So in terms of receiving a grade, Rachel has her way of grading. But what that means for me is that I will produce a poster and or a paper at the end of the semester and present it at some kind of science symposium, like the College of Natural Science poster session at Chico State. Or also something we're doing this semester and we've done previously is we present at national meetings, like the Geological Society of America meeting that's happening next week.
Wow. And where's that?
In Flagstaff, Arizona.
Ooh, that's one of the coolest places to study geology.
Mm-hmm.
And can you tell me what do you think? Because when a lot of people think about being an undergraduate, you don't get the opportunity to do research. But you guys are getting this opportunity to do real science and not just, you know, canned labs and book learning kind of thing. What's the value of this, do you think, for you?
One of the reasons why I saw that there was an opportunity to do undergrad research. It's kind of nice when you're learning a subject and then get to apply it firsthand in a setting outside of your classroom. So it's happening real time. So you have to kind of learn and think on your feet. And since you're still a student who is still learning a lot of aspects of the major and the subject, that you are kind of not forced, but like you need to research on your own. And that kind of helps with the process. You kind of become, I feel very well-rounded this semester. Since my clay analysis is not, I'm not learning about it in a classroom setting in any of my classes this semester. So I don't know how to word it. It's kind of just well-rounding out my learning experience as an undergrad.
Well, is there anything that any kind of misconceptions you think that people have about, you know, studying geology and the kind of work you're doing when, you know, you try to, like when you go out with friends and you tell them what you're doing, what are some of the things that you run into where you have to kind of set them straight about what it is that you do?
Although Lassen is classified as an inactive volcano, there's nothing inactive about it. The hydrothermal system is very active. You can see it driving through the park, the bubbling mud pots, that's all part of the hydrothermal system. And that's an indication of what's happening at the subsurface. So it's a very active, seemingly inactive area, in my opinion. And I try and share that with other people.
Angie, I believe you are the one, you're doing a study to look at the water in the system to determine which ones are meteoric versus magmatic. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So explain to us what the difference between meteoric water, because I'm assuming that doesn't come from meteorites, and magmatic water, which I'm thinking probably comes from hot rock down deep. Could you explain that to us a little bit?
Yeah, so it has to do with the water cycle. What we look at in the waters that we collect is the oxygen isotopes. And an oxygen isotope is the ratio of oxygen 18 to oxygen 16. So meteoric water, like rainwater and snow water, it has a lot of oxygen 16. So if you have a fraction and the number on the bottom is really big, your overall number is going to be really small. So small oxygen isotopes indicate meteoric sources.
So meteoric meaning coming from rainfall and snowfall, the water percolating down from above.
Yes, mm-hmm, exactly. Okay. And so that's, if you think of it on a number line, a negative number indicates meteoric sources. And then on the very opposite side, a positive number with a positive, very big numerator in your fraction, that's going to give you a very big number. And that's things that are magmatic, that have magmatic sources.
I'm wondering, does that water actually come, I'm thinking just kind of off the top of the head here, so if I'm wrong about this, correct me, but is that water actually coming from out in the ocean through the magma system, you know, through the subduction of the slab out there, that water comes from the Pacific Ocean as the original source?
No, it comes through the water cycle. It precipitates as rain and snow onto the southwest flank of Lassen Peak, and then it percolates through fractures and cracks in the ground, and then it's heated by the magma chamber at the subsurface, and then it's heated to such a high temperature that it boils up, kind of like when you're boiling water for coffee, and mm-hmm. Then that steam in that water, that really hot water, is what feeds all the hydrothermal features at Sulphur Works and various other hydrothermal areas.
I'd like to know, talking to people who are your age, young people, younger than me anyway, what is it about science that draws you? Why do you really enjoy this? And because a lot of people don't view science as something that's like, oh yeah, that's something I'd like to do. Why do you like doing it, and why do you think it's fun?
This is Amy. My love of science, before I went back to school, I always kind of named myself a science nerd. Anything that popped up on TV, radio articles, I would always read and try to consume as much information as I could. It's the curiosity. It's that same curiosity that you have as a kid on why. Why does this happen? Why, you know, why is the sky blue? How do rainbows happen? All of that. You're answering those questions, but there's always questions that need to be answered. And that's the fascination with science, is that you're trying to explain the world around you, but it explains the world around you, but there's always something to be explained. And so you're always asking questions. And that's why I like science.
Do you guys find that when you tell other people that you're not, you know, that aren't fellow students, just people you run into, family, friends, that you are a scientist, you're studying science. What kind of respect level do you get from them? Do they think that's cool? Because it seems to me science is in a strange state of flux in this country, where there's a lot of people that just love science and think it's wonderful, and some people that just don't think it's important at all.
This is Amy. I've come from a household where I feel I have lucked out with family that's been highly supportive of my career goals. My father, when I first told him I was going back to school and I was going back to school for geology, I come from a family of lawyers and artists, and he was trying to wonder where that gene came from. But luckily, I found out when he was younger, he was actually a rock hound. So there's a little enthusiasm there, and I've been very fortunate to be around people who are very supportive of science and who have some degree of enthusiasm, or probably not as high as my enthusiasm, but definitely there. And I have not been met with any resistance to the idea of science, fortunately, but I'm always willing to have a good conversation with someone who has questions.
Well, I would like to share with you one last thought before I let you go, is that my own daughter started her study of geology with your professor, and she wound up getting a job as a federal scientist, which is a really rewarding, it's a difficult job, and it's also got a lot of politics involved, if you know, catch my drift, with the current administration. But she loves it, and it definitely has been a great career for her. And she started out doing the same kind of things you guys are doing.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's awesome.
All right. Well, Amy and Angie, Amy Robeson and Angie Rodriguez from CSU Chico, thanks a lot for talking to us today. I really enjoyed visiting with you about your work, your undergraduate research projects up at Lassen Volcanic National Park.
All right. Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Schlom. When we come back from a break, we'll hear from another undergraduate student, Evan Davis, who is modeling lava flows to replicate a lava flow on Mars in a region that is analogous to the Hawaiian Islands on Earth. And we're back. Our next guest is Evan Davis, another geology student under the direction of Professor Rachel Teasdale at CSU Chico. Evan is investigating a lava flow on Mars by computer modeling its emplacement on the red planet. Evan, welcome to Blue Dot.
Hi, thank you.
I understand that you're doing an interesting project about modeling lava flows on Mars. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
And before we get into that, could you just tell us a little bit about how did you first get interested in geology and decide that this is what you wanted to do as your major?
As a kid, I've always been interested in the rocks, but geology wasn't the thing that drew me to school initially. But I went through a round of college and ended up taking a year off that was quite longer than a year. But I've come back to school, and I came back to pursue a degree in geosciences to become a science educator at the middle school or high school level. And while taking my Geology 101 class, I just sort of fell in love with geology and went and talked to the chair of the department about possibly getting a minor in geology. And he just said, you should probably just major in geology, actually, which was definitely the better choice for me. And offer of education is still there with a geology degree, but there is just a lot more in-depth studying of geology that I get to do now.
And tell us a bit about your research project. How did you decide to do that?
Well, I am a huge fan of the podcast Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson before I came back to school.
Certainly.
And there's a lot of planetary geology that gets discussed there, and so I'd always kind of been a little bit interested in planetary geology. And when I went to go meet with Rachel, the program advisor, she knew that I was interested in planetary geology, and since she's a volcanologist herself, this kind of was a perfect way to mesh my interests with her expertise.
And so tell us the exact title of your research project. Give me the really technical, nerdy title.
Okay. Using FLOGO to model the emplacement of a lava flow in the Tharsis region of Mars.
Okay, so let me see if I can decipher that a bit. The Tharsis region of Mars, that's where the giant shield volcanoes are, like the largest mountain in the solar system, Olympus Mons, right?
Yes, so it's a series of three shield volcanoes to the southeast of Olympus Mons that is dubbed the Tharsis Montes.
And explain to us what those volcanoes are like in terms of comparing them to what we find on Earth.
Yeah, so something really similar to them that we could see on Earth would be Hawaii. They're just, they're large shield volcanoes that are formed from hotspot volcanism basalts that just build and are very wide and don't go very tall compared to their base. But as we said earlier, Olympus Mons is the tallest mountain in the solar system.
And they're huge, and they're not just tall, they're very large in size. Their diameters are gigantic.
Yeah, exactly.
And so they're similar to the Hawaiian volcanoes. And coincidentally, while we're doing this interview, have you been checking out what's been going on the Big Island of Hawaii?
We have been watching it very closely. In the group of student researchers under Rachel, we are actually poised and ready to go and study some lava if we can. But the flow currently is not quite right for us.
Why is that?
It's just a little bit too sticky currently, to put it plainly, but we want some really flowy pahoehoe, and right now it is ah-ah flows.
Ooh, I love those terms, pahoehoe and ah-ah. Can you explain to us the difference between a pahoehoe flow and an ah-ah flow?
Yeah, a pahoehoe flow is much more liquid and flows sort of like a syrup, whereas our ah-ah is more jagged and sticky, and that's what we see kind of exploding with gases. And what some of my fellow geologists always say is, ah-ah is what you say when you walk on it because it hurts.
Because it's all jagged.
Yeah.
And those ah-ah flows that I've seen on television, you know, they're moving very slowly. You could literally walk right up to them.
Yeah.
Whereas, now, why is the pahoehoe flow of more interest to you?
The pahoehoe flow can be followed a little bit easier, and we can follow a specific piece and gather samples along its path and along its evolution as it cools on the surface of the Earth.
So it's easier to actually collect the specimens, of the lava.
Yeah, it's much easier.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. And then what would you do with that?
Well, we want to examine how crystals form in the lava as they are emplaced. So we want to examine the lava at different stages along its path to see how many crystals there are. And so we can compare that to other flows here and compare them.
And so then tell us about Mars. When will you be having your field trip to collect some samples there?
Well, hopefully soon, but I don't think there's anything planned in the future for me to go.
Do you think maybe someday you might be a geologist, you know, checking, you know, think about it now, you're doing this wonderful research project, but gosh, as when you get to be my age, you might actually be there collecting samples from what you're studying.
I'm sure someone could go and collect some samples, but I don't know if I will be the one there.
Not something that really interests you. Well, you know, not maybe would interest you, but not something you visualize yourself doing.
It's a fantastic thought. I think that the competition to get there probably would be quite high. And I think I'll be focusing my efforts on a lot of different things. And
well, back to, you know, it must be really cool for you guys, all of you geology students, to be seeing something like this in the news, and especially for you since you're studying that type of volcano. What are some of the things that you do, you know, when we watch it on TV, of course, we all go, ooh, wow, and that's too bad those houses are burning down. But what are some of the things that you can learn just by what you see in the news reports?
Well, we also look at it and go, ooh, look at that's awesome, and those poor people have to be displaced and the houses are burning down. But some we can look at that flow in the news, and we also have updates from the HVO, the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, and watching the trajectory of the flow can give us the ability to and predict other flows in the future by watching the pattern of behavior of this one.
So you are modeling lava flows on Mars. How do you go about doing that? How do you model lava flows on Mars?
Well, so there's a program that was created by some other researchers called FLOGO, and it's a series of equations that numerically calculate the dimensions and rheology of the flow as when you put in dimensions for it starting.
So what would be, like, give me an example of what those kinds of inputs would be.
So the inputs that are necessary would be the size of the start of the channel. So you need your depth and your width, and your length of the flow is good to know as well, so you can double check stuff. But as far as the rheological inputs, we need viscosity, and we need the amount of crystals present at the beginning of the flow, and we need the flow temperature.
Could you explain to us what that term means, rheological?
Yeah, rheology is just the study of how things flow. So it's just liquid properties.
So yeah, how thick the lavas are, and the temperatures and things like that.
Yes.
I see. And so this is computer modeling that you're doing.
Yeah, it's just in an Excel spreadsheet, just was set up by a previous student who I've gotten lucky to did all the hard work.
And so what kind of background do you, I'm just curious about what kind of software understanding, computer knowledge you need in order to do that? Because, you know, that sounds like something that I would have a difficult time with. But what do you need to know as a prerequisite for that?
Just a basic understanding of Excel is all that we need for this program, which is why we selected it, because the entry level is fairly accessible for most people.
What do you foresee yourself doing with your geology degree down the road after this work and you graduate?
That's a tough question because everything sounds so interesting in the field of geology to me. But I am still drawn to the idea of teaching, but possibly at a community college or at a state college level, so I can actually teach specifically geology.
Could you explain to us, what do you see as the value in being able to do research like this as an undergraduate?
Well, you really get the excitement of figuring things out and making discoveries, and that is kind of the thing that keeps you coming back to science, is when you get that small victory, and then another question appears, and you have to go answer that, and you don't really get that when there is an answer book and an answer key that you can check.
So, Evan, Rachel Teasdale tells me you're going to get to go on an opportunity for a cruise. Could you tell us about what that's all about?
Yeah, I still haven't gotten too much detail on it, but we're going to be setting sail out of Oregon and researching the axial seamount off the coast.
And what's an axial seamount?
So it's an underwater lava flow.
And that's the Juan de Fuca Ridge?
Yes.
So that's a place off the coast where the actual process of seafloor spreading is happening. Is that right?
Yes.
I'll throw in that axial seamount has erupted 3 times in the last 6 years. So we're right on target if we go with a 2-year interval. Maybe Evan will be there during an eruption.
Wow. And yeah, so how do you go about studying an undersea eruption? What kind of instrumentation's involved in that, if you could give us a real quick overview of that?
Sure. So you can't study an underwater volcano like we do on land, where we use a lot of satellites. But recently, some cabled instruments have been installed. So there are cables reaching from axial seamount to shore. So that's like 200 miles of cabled network of instruments. So there's seismometers there, so we can detect earthquakes. There are also tilt meters. So as magma rises up through the crust, the volcano will swell to accommodate that new magma before it erupts. And so those can both be detected on land.
And Evan, are you pretty excited about getting to go do that?
I'm extremely excited about this, yeah.
Now that sounds like fun. You get to be an ocean-going geologist.
Yeah, he's going to have the Jason remotely operated vehicle there, so he'll get lots of opportunity to see video of the ocean floor through the eyes of Jason's cameras.
And are you going to learn to sing sea shanties and wear a big cable sweater?
I'm sure that they teach you that before you get on the boat.
Yeah, make sure you do that. Well, Rachel and Evan and Amy and Angie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us. We really appreciate being able to tell folks about what great work these students are doing.
Great answer. That was fantastic. Well, Evan, thank you so much for joining us on Blue Dot, and best of luck to you with your research project.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks to our guests, Eric Clementi from Denison University in Ohio. Check out his blog, Rocky Planet, on the Discover Magazine website. And California State University professor Rachel Teasdale, along with her undergraduate researchers Amy Robson, Angie Rodriguez, and Evan Davis. Thanks for listening, and stick around to see if we make it to 200 episodes. Check out this and past programs at our website, mynspr.org, and subscribe to Blue Dot at NPR Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Shlom. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Our producer and engineer is the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.